Mitzvah Resh Lamed Vav 236. Shelo Liragil, not to gossip. Now we know that the Jewish people has often had a contentious relationship with this mitzvah, but we'll try to understand the halachos as best as we can. Shanim nanu min harechilos, that we are not allowed to engage in gossip. Shanemar lo selech rechil, we shall not run around as gossip mongers. V'ha'inyan hu she'im nishma adam medabe rabba chaviro, that you hear two people having a conversation, and you're eavesdropping on their lovely conversation. You hear that, lo and behold, one party in the conversation is maligning another person to the person who is listening to him. So, shelo nelech elav unasaper lo ploni medaber bach kach v'chach. So the rechilas per se, what's the gossip per se according to the Torah, is that you heard someone being maligned, and then you go to the person who that you heard these words about, and you said, you know that so-and-so is speaking ill of you. You know, maybe you should do something. They don't have to suggest they do something about it, but the implication being that the person will now take your words and will now will very poorly impact, negatively impact the relationship between those two people, and could lead to strife, etc., etc. Elim kein tia kavanoso lesilu kanezokin lahashbis riv. So here we have a very important principle in the laws of proper speech in general, that if your intention in relating the negative information is to get rid of damage or to, in fact, quiet the controversy, so maybe you know that these people have the type of relationship, person being maligned and the maligner, that they really like each other, Betsim. They're just that one guy happens to be saying something negative. So maybe you should, if your intention really, really, really is to say to the guy, you know, maybe you want to go over and correct this impression of you that this guy was saying, I'm no, and the guy would say, oh, you know, I totally understand why that guy could have thought that thing about me, but you know, it's really wrong, he misunderstood, he didn't do what we learned in the last mitzvah, which is dan l'chaf schus, they have to judge everybody favorably and give everyone the benefit of the doubt. So he said, oh, well, he didn't do that, but you know, it's really understandable, so therefore I'm going to go correct him, and eventually it's actually going to positively impact the relationship between the two people, therefore you're allowed to do it. This is the principle of what we call l'toeles, that in general, when we talk about the laws of negative speech, we'll talk about Lashon Hara in a minute. Here we're talking about Rechilos, which is a slightly different concept, as we'll explain, that the implication, by definition, of the rules are that it means to cause harm. But if your intention in speaking is you have to, you know, the Chofetz Chaim, we'll talk about more in a few minutes, the Chofetz Chaim in his work gives a whole list of criteria of what you have to think in order for it to really be considered the Toelas, to be considered a positive type of negative speech as opposed to negative speech. But the basic idea is that you have in mind that really you're not interested in spreading negative information about anyone, but rather you're trying to and eventually accomplish a positive goal with your speech over here. So for example, like when we talk about the Lashon Hara, which is, we'll get in a second, which is the more direct type of negative speech, which is the not the going to tell someone that someone else spoke negatively about him, that's Rechilos. But what about Lashon Hara? Bad speech, or the bad tongue, or the tongue of causing evil, different translations, is when you speak directly in any type of negative thing about another person. So that's waived when you have the principle of litoelis. And there's the post-game right that you can't give exact qualifications as to what's considered litoelis, because it's going to change in every situation. You just have to weigh every single situation in consultation with the proper authorities, that as to whether it's really Toelis or not. So for example, you find in Shiduchim that somebody asks you, you know, how is this guy? I'd like him to marry my daughter. So if you say, well, oh, Lashon Hara, I can't say anything bad about this guy, even
it's
though he's really a terrible person, but I can't say anything bad about him because laws of Lashon Hara preclude this. So that's wrong, because that's not Lashon Hara by definition, because your intention is not, if you were left to your own devices, you wouldn't have opened your mouth about this person, because you're very careful about the laws of Lashon Hara. But you, in this situation where your negative information is really to prevent someone else from getting into trouble, then that's not Lashon Hara. That's positive overall. So the sages tell us, and when we explain what rachil is, what does that mean? Rach lezeh v'kosha lezeh. So rachil is sort of like the two words rach, meaning soft, and kosha, meaning difficult, smushed together, rachil. So you're easy on one person and bad on another person. Davaracher lo se kerochel. One other thing is, another means that a rochel is a peddler. So a peddler goes throughout all the towns and he says, who wants this? You know, I see, take one thing from another town and I bring it to this town to sell and back and forth, take it. So they do the same thing with information. Matin dvarim beholech. Every time you hear something juicy, you add it to your stockpile of goods and then you peddle it later on. Ooh, I heard this. So no good. I remember also there's a story in the book about Rav Pams. There's another example of Lashon Hara L'Toeles that where they went into a shir. He and his son went into a shir, and clearly the person giving the shir did not know what he was talking about. So Rav Pam said to his son, so you see what it looks like when someone doesn't prepare for a shir? So the son said, at first he was very taken aback. Rav Pam was known as a little Chofetz Chaim. He was, in this generation, he was extremely diligent about not speaking negatively. So his son realized that that's also an example of Lashon Hara L'Toeles, because his whole intention was not to malign the person giving the shir, but to make sure that his son, whenever he gave a shir in the future, properly prepared, and to point out this is what it can look like when you don't prepare. Yeah.
And he picked his language carefully. He said, "This is what it looks like when blah blah blah." He didn't say, "Oh my God, that guy's doing a terrible job."
Exactly.
100%. Like trying to distance himself.
But if you just want to, shtuch the shir, the
equivalent.
Right. Not quite, because he's not saying the guy's an idiot.
When someone doesn't prepare
for a shear, not this is someone who's an idiot. He
was being as careful as he could, it seems to me.
Right. There's no way of getting out of some of negativity here, but the idea is that he tried to do it as best as possible. Right. Mishor sheha mitzvah, what are the reasoning behind this mitzvah? Ki Hashem chafetz betova sabrios asher bara v'tzivanu v'zeh. Kedelio shalom beineinu, because God wants there to be good between people and people to have benefit and good attached to them. And he commanded us that there should be peace between us. Obviously, that when people are going around slandering each other, telling people that, that they spoke negatively about you, then that's no good. Then that's going to cause a lot of strife and problems. Prati ha-mitzvah, the details of the mitzvah, the rov ha-zharoshis hirunu zichronam levrachal ha-rechilus. So all the many details of the mitzvahs that the sages gave us governing rechilus, and the lashon hara shutafo. Lashon hara, he says, is his partner. It's partner in crime. So lashon hara, according to most authorities, is considered to be even worse than Rechilos, because it's more direct, although there are shitas that Rechilos is worse. I mean, it's not such a big nafkamina, because you're not allowed to do either one. So the question is just a sort of a conceptual analysis. So Yisbaru b'makomos me'atalmuz b'medrashos b'pizor. So here it's actually a very interesting comment that the Sefer Chinuch makes over here, that he says that the laws are not found in any one place in the Talmud. They're found strewn all about. So that's the reason why there was a lot of confusion regarding the laws of Lashon Hara and Rechilos. So who saved us from all this confusion and all of these things being splattered around everywhere in the Gemara and the Midrashim? The Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim was the first one who compiled a systematic halachic work where he collected all these things from all the random Gemaras that discuss Lashon Hara that imply certain things. Again, there's no systematic presentation of the laws of Lashon Hara by any means in the Gemara, or in the classical, even in the Rishonim, it's not really one systematic presentation. Really, it's talking there, just like the Rambam, for example, in Hilchos Deos, when he discusses each mitzvah and the explanation of each mitzvah, so when he gets to Lashon Hara, so he explains the laws of Lashon Hara. But you have things like, for example, Rabbeinu Yonah wrote a sefer called Shari Tshuva, very appropriate for this time of year. So the Shari Tshuva is just a book about generally how to repent. So he says, well, if you did this sin, you should be careful because you could have been nichshal in it this way, and this way, and this way, and this way, and then this is how you repent for it. So one of the examples he gives is, well, there's Lashon Hara, which you could do this way, and this way, and this way, and this way, and very, very, very not centrally located. But if you look in the Rambams, the discussion of the laws of Lashon Hara is approximately 3 paragraphs. It's very, very short. And it doesn't cover all the details that you really need to know. So the Chofetz Chaim was trying to gather all these things and present a systematic explanation of the laws of Lashon Hara. So he literally wrote the book on this. That's why people study his book in order to learn all the laws of Lashon Hara. But it's important to know that not everybody agrees with all the conclusions of the Chofetz Chaim, because again, there's so much room for left for interpretation, because again, it was not presented so in such detail or so systematically. So he's trying to construct his own system of all these things that he found in the Gemara and the Rishonim.
Chofetz Chaim, he took basically things that were general injunctions or sort of made them into like specific halachas, as it were.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And that is that the. I mean, you know, is that a problem of trying basically coming up with a, as we're, isn't that sort of coming up with a new halacha instead of rather than simply saying something, you know, like, after all, it's like there are other mitzvahs like, you know, lifnei'iver or something like that, you know, which, you know, the general, discussed, there's not a halacha about lifnei'iver, you know, not a book rather, you know, specifying all.
I mean, maybe nowadays there is, but.
Nowadays, yeah. Okay. But in general, it seems as though.
No, he felt it was necessary in our generation where. You know, in other words, there's certain mitzvahs that people that were not thoroughly discussed in previous generations because it was just part of people's feeling. People knew that there was a general concept of lashon hara, so they tried as best they could not to speak ill of others, and until a certain point, so that was sufficient to maintain society functioning properly. Mm-hmm. Another example you can maybe give is tznius. Now, in the classical sources, there's extremely minimal discussion.
I know it when I see it.
Right, there's extremely minimal discussion of how people have to dress. In terms of how people have to dress in terms of modesty. But nowadays you have tons and tons and tons of guidelines of exact details. So the reason is that nowadays it's so bad that people just dress the way everybody else is dressing in the world, so it's going to be terrible. In the olden days, that wasn't, you know.
There wasn't everybody else.
Right, everybody was dressing relatively modestly. And so it wasn't really an issue, and people didn't think about it necessarily as a halachic issue. They just said, we're Jewish, we dress modestly, this is how people dress, it's not a problem, so end of the story. But nowadays, post-kin feel, we need more strict guidelines of exactly what to do. So the same thing.
Who determines what the strict guidelines
are? I didn't mean strict versus lenient. That's not what I meant as strict versus lenient. I just meant more explicit guidelines. That's properly. Yeah, but that's what you have to do. You have to decide what's the rabbis and post-giving combined with the feeling amongst Orthodox Jewish women have to decide what the proper standard is going to be.
All the time, the question is, you know, what is really halachically necessary?
I mean, yeah, there are a few things, very few things discussed in the Chazal, obviously discussed covering hair for married women. Gemara doesn't say explicitly married women, but we assume it only applies to married women. It says you're not allowed to go with very short sleeves or sleeves that show your torso. Yeah, I mean.
You know what we mean.
Right, but.
So, as far as I know, the Ramos said that everything up to a tefach from the elbow is okay, but that's no longer acceptable.
No, you're talking about a separate halacha, which is that you're not allowed to recite Kriyashma or Dvarim Shebikdusha in the presence of a woman who's not a man. It's not allowed to recite in the presence of a woman who's not properly dressed. So, even if she's not properly dressed, if there's a tefach showing of a place where the woman normally covers, she's still allowed to recite Kriyashma. But more than a tefach showing, you're not allowed to recite Kriyashma. But nobody says that a woman is allowed to lechatchila uncover a tefach of an area that is normally covered. Right? Nowadays, some people actually tie it into the advent of newspapers. That they would be, now that since newspapers became more popular, right. So people had a much bigger audience,
yes.
And that possibly slandering someone could be a much bigger career and life and reputation killer. So therefore, that's why he felt he had to come up with this thing.
It is kind of hard. I mean, the analogy with Stinus doesn't really seem whole because the society. You know, everything, the society at large became black, but the, you know, the Yitzhar for Lashon Hara
was always there.
I can't believe there was any, you know, worse in, you know, around the Chofetz Chaim than it was like 100, 300,000 years before.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much a constant and,
Yes, but you're right, that's true. It doesn't, yeah. But it's also that there's just more of a drive to systemization and halachic handbooks that people, it's the same thing as he wrote the Mishneh Berurah, that people in the olden days didn't study halacha as much, especially people who are less learned. You know, they listened to the rabbis' drushes, they knew what they had, they learned that they from their growing up at home. That was it. So when a train got transferred much more, it was much more a democratization of learning at least basic halachic work. So therefore, he wrote the Chofetz Chaim, and the Mishneh Berurah is along the same line, that he digested all the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch HaRach Chaim, so that people would be able to learn themselves without too much, you know, without having to look on all the sorts of different places, the basic idea of explanation of the halachos that we do on a daily basis.
Isn't it true that in the German community they interpreted the remark to say that up until, you know, above the elbow it's okay, because
not aware.
That's how the women were dressed. up to.
I mean, in a lot of places in Europe, they didn't adhere to what we consider.
Here.
What?
Here. Right. In Washington Heights.
In okay, until, you know, the Orthodox community is. In many communities that were otherwise completely Orthodox, did not completely adhere to the laws of Tznias as we know and love them nowadays. Mm-hmm. That's true. But they had probably a different interpretation. You're working backwards. You're saying, for sure, a woman has to cover to here, and therefore, if the German community was covering to here, so therefore they were makil on showing a tefach lechatchila. Maybe they only held that they had to cover it here, because that was what was accepted in the community, and that you didn't have to cover it here. They didn't hold of this, that was an actual absolute halacha. That's a different approach. Okay. So the Chofetz Chaim... So a certain extent, when you write the book on something, so you get to present the world according to you. So it's almost like the Shmira Shabbos Kilchasa, who was the first work that really comprehensively addressed the observance of Shabbos in the modern era, including all the stuff about electricity and things like that. And so he wrote the book. So that's why everybody says when they are looking up new shailas about Shabbos, oh, the Shmira Shabbos is this, Shmira Shabbos is that. There are a lot of poskim who disagree with the Shmira Shabbos about every little detail that he says that. But he got to present the world according to him because he wrote the book first. That doesn't mean that your local rabbi can't say, you know, what we pass differently from the Chofetz Chaim or the Shmira Shabbos Pilchas or anything like that. But it's just to be aware that there are people who disagree about various details. But I said, go ahead, definitely learn the Chofetz Chaim. Great, you know, great work. It'd be very important. And he gives a lot of mussar in the work. He says if you say Lashon Hara, so he collects the different statements in Chazal, which are not necessarily meant literally, but that's if you say Lashon Hara, so you violate also the mitzvah of Hishomer Benega Tzaras, to be very careful not to contract Tzaras, because we know that Tzaras was the punishment for Lashon Hara amongst other Averos, but the main thing was for Lashon Hara. So, and also Losi Sashay Mashav, don't bear a false testimony, which is not, again, it's not literally what the Pasuk is talking about, but the Chazal say that if you say Lashon Hara, so you're sort of violate all these things as well, because it's alluded to in these other mitzvahs. So Chofetz Chaim gives a lot of mussar that you violate all these different commandments if you, in fact, say Lashon Hara beyond, you know, the tame presentation that the Sefer Chinuch is giving over here, that it makes it seem bad, but he really drills it into you. So definitely worthwhile to learn. And but people disagree about certain details. An excellent book, by the way, about Lashon Hara nowadays is just came out, debuted at the past YU's Farm Cell, which is Rabbi Daniel Feldman.
Oh, he's great.
False Facts and True Rumors. It's called Lashon Hara in Contemporary Culture, which is Chofetz Chaim again.
Atlantic City?
No,
from Teaneck. So the Chofetz Chaim was written, you know, over 100 years ago. It was 150 years ago, actually. So he says, so a lot of things need to be updated nowadays for contemporary. His book is not a comprehensive presentation in the same way that the Chofetz Chaim is, but he has essays there where he discusses the application. First of all, a very important thing is that he collects all the people who have maybe disagreed with various points in the Chofetz Chaim's work, who have published in articles as opposed to in comprehensive books. Mm-hmm. So people don't necessarily know about them because they're in periodicals. They're scattered, exactly. So he did another collection, collected all these things, which is very very good to learn. And he discusses during the contemporary shidduch scene, how does it apply in terms of job interviews, in terms of all these things, the journalism, all these things, how does Lashon Hara apply to all these things? It's a very, very, very important work in terms of updating, to a certain extent, the Chofetz Chaim for contemporary times. So Chazal say Maseches Erchin, which is interesting. Nothing, obviously, the topic of the tractate has nothing to do with Lashon Hara, but it's where a lot of the discussion of Lashon Hara is found in the Gemara. Shememis, so it kills Haomro, that those who say it, Bahamekablo Vahanamar Alav, that one who says it, one who receives it, and that the person upon whom the subject of Lashon Hara, yeah. So Chazal emphasize that one of actually the most stringent prohibitions regarding Lashon Hara, which is very important to know, is not speaking the Lashon Hara, but receiving the Lashon Hara. That, in other words,
there's no market.
Exactly. If there's no market, then people are not going to have Lashon Hara. So I get it, to a certain extent, you know, once it's said, so it's out of the person who said its hand. So then the people who hear it have to process it and deal with it. So the idea is that it's completely forbidden to receive, to accept the Lashon Hara. So what does that mean? So it's also a machlokes between the Chofetz Chaim and other poskim. The Chofetz Chaim says what it means is that you're not allowed to believe it at all in your heart. Completely. That
what
says
you
that
believe
he's,
is not in your control.
So you say like the other poskim. Mm-hmm. Very good. So the Chofetz Chaim says that you have to work on yourself and work on yourself, work on yourself, that you absolutely don't believe it in your heart. He says there are certain exceptions that if somebody who, you know, you trust with your life and you would never suspect of saying a falsehood, so it says something, so then there are more leniencies. But if a regular person tells you something, a Lashon Hara, you should absolutely not believe it. You are allowed to, l'mechash mibayi, says the Gemara, that you're allowed to be concerned for it. So if somebody tells you that so-and-so is a poor business partner, and then the guy comes to you the next day and says, you know, I have a great opportunity, you give me some money to invest, and I'll make you lots of money, so you're allowed to say no. You're not allowed, you don't have to completely ignore it. That's completely unreasonable. Obviously, if somebody tells you something, that could potentially be to your harm, so you have to act accordingly. But according to the Chofetz Chaim, what that means is that you believe that the Lashon Hara is completely false, but you just ought to protect yourself, so you act as if just in this one area, maybe wow, there's a chance it might be true, even though you, in your heart of hearts, you absolutely don't believe it. That's the Chofetz Chaim.
Mental gymnastics.
Right, that's the Chofetz Chaim. According to other poskim, Chazanish, another says, that's unreasonable. There's no way you're not going to believe it. Somebody, you assume, there's no reason to be lying to you, is going to tell you the, you assume he's going to tell you the truth. So what it means is that you're allowed to, I mean, you're going to believe it. It's an accepted fact that you're going to, it's a fait accompli that you're going to accept, that you're going to believe it. But what it just means is you're not allowed to have it impact your perception of this person negatively. So in other areas besides the third thing that this person is warning you about right now, you should treat it as if it's it doesn't exist. That's what it means. But to believe it, but practically in terms of your relationship with this person, there's no difference between the different shitas. All the only difference is what goes on in your mind. So everybody agrees you're allowed to act as if it might be true in order to protect yourself. And everybody agrees that it shouldn't affect any other aspect of the relationship or your thoughts about this type of person. The only thing is, do you actually, it's a very slight, dachistica thing, that is, do you actually believe this item of information that this person told you or not?
Well, the fact is that if you're acting on it to the degree that you say no to the author,
yeah,
you do believe it, and
so you say, like the other poskim, you say the Chofetz Chaim is too impractical, that it's such a slight distinction that it's impossible for a human being to get to that level.
I mean, just because somebody says something negative about somebody doesn't mean that they hate them or that they're trying to cause trouble. It means they're trying to protect other people from this person.
Yeah, but sometimes they could be saying it in a malicious way.
Yeah,
in other words, it's mutter. If it's allowed to say something negative, again, if you know 100% for certain that this person is a bad business partner, so you are allowed to warn others that the person is a bad business partner.
You ought to.
Right, that you should, yes, of course. No, 100%, you should. But the question is that even if you're being malicious, you could be saying the truth, but even if you're being malicious and you want to be, you know, mean to that person, you don't really care about this person making a bad business deal with the other guy. But you tell him anyway, just because you don't like the guy who's making the bad business deal with people. Even so, the person who hears Lashon Hara is allowed to protect him or herself from the damage.
But of course, again, the thing which is important about Lashon Hara is that Lashon Hara is something which is true.
Absolutely,
it's not motzi shemra. It's not slander.
Right. All these things are true that we've been discussing.
So in other words, Chofetz Chaim is saying that there is something which qualifies as Lashon Hara.
Yeah, but you don't know if it's Lashon Hara or Motzi Shem Ra.
Well, you don't know, okay, but the point is that if he says something which, you know, let's say, you know, I mean, he has proof for something like that, whatever it was, or there's something, you know, it is something which, if you thought that the guy was lying, wouldn't you come to the...
Right, if you have a real reason to suspect the guy is lying, so go ahead, go on the business venture.
Here somebody says something, yeah, and you have every reason to believe that it's true.
Oh, this is min hastam. This means that you don't have a particular relationship with a person telling you the information where you know him to always be a truthful person. It's just a regular person that you don't know so well comes and tells you. Yeah. Yeah, but that's very important. We have to emphasize that everything, Lashon Hara and Rechilus, are by definition true. That's everybody knows that by now, because everybody's been darshaning about the Chofetz Chaim for so many years. Everyone knows Lashon Hara, but in people who don't know better often think, well, it's not Lashon Hara. How could it be Lashon Hara? I can tell it's true. Lashon Hara means that you say something about someone else that's negative and not true. That's completely false. That's a much higher level of prohibition. That's called Motzi Shemra. That to say a lie about someone else that's negative about that person is an unbelievably high level of prohibition, much, much worse than even Lashon Hara and Rechilos. And the halacha is that even if somebody comes to you on Erev Yom Kippur, you don't have to forgive that person for being Motzi Shemra on you, because it's basically unfixable. Mm. Again, we know where's that line that somebody was, maybe some politician was embroiled in a scandal and it really wasn't true, and eventually it came out. Where it came out that there was absolutely false, but everybody already thought negatively about this person because there was so much controversy surrounding him. So he said, well, is there anything else you'd like? And they asked him, is there anything else you'd like after this whole scandal? So he said, where can I go to get back my good name?
Yeah.
So that's terrible. I mean, yeah. Anyway, so in general...
What?
No.
I didn't even know who I'm talking about, but I heard that there was some politician.
It's a well-known.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really
so. Normally, and especially in general, but especially in the holiday season, when someone says, "Look, I sinned against you, and I really like your forgiveness," and the person is really sincere in asking forgiveness, and then you're really supposed to forgive that person. But if the person said motzi shemra, then you don't have to forgive the person because it's considered to be such an unbelievably unfixable affront. Then it's Which is also the famous machlokes between the Chofetz Chaim and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, that they say this is the reason that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter wouldn't give a haskama to the Sefer Chofetz Chaim, because the Chofetz Chaim says that when you say Lashon Hara about someone, then you have to go ask forgiveness before Yom Kippur, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter felt that you don't have to go ask forgiveness, because it emphasizes the idea of Lashon Hara, because it's just going to create more strife between you two, rather to just let the issue die quietly. It's one issue where you should not ask forgiveness. So there's different. Rabbi Feldman talks about it in his Sefer as an interesting little footnote, historical footnote about that. That some people say that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter just didn't give haskamas to books at all. He wouldn't give, for even to his biggest Talmud, publishes the Tshuva Sefer, he wouldn't give haskama. He just didn't do it. Some say no, he really didn't give haskama because he felt that this detail was, this tiny little thing cast a pall on the entire Sefer Chofetz Chaim, that he just felt that he couldn't affix his name to such a thing.
Reasonable point of view, you're causing more damage than you originally did.
Right, so look at the Rabbi Feldman Sefer, he talks about details. Maybe the Chofetz Chaim didn't exactly mean that, maybe they're closer than you think they are. Okay, whatever. Vizhiru harbe alav, that the Chazal obviously emphasized this very much. Ad she'amru derech mashal, so they said as a parable, man de'is gifa berukse lo lema leizkov binisa. So this is very odd, as the commentators point out on the Sefer Chinuch, which is that the Gemara in Bava Metzia says that somebody who had someone in his family who was impaled on a stake, what? Or hung or something like that, then you should not say to someone, to that person, here's a fish to dry, hang up this fish, because it's going to remind the person of the person, their relative who was put to death by the hanging type of method. In any event, the commentators of Rechino says the Gemara is not talking about Lashon Hara over there. That's talking about a different prohibition, which is called Onas Dvarim,
right,
which means that you're not allowed to cause someone emotional pain. Mm-hmm. So this is not Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara means that you speak ill of another person to the person. So people cannot understand exactly why the Sefer Chinuch brings this over here. That is forbidden. Everybody reads that's Usur, but not because of this reason. We'll get to Onos Dvarim later in the Sefer Chinuch. In all places, in all times, in males and females.
Would anybody suppose that it doesn't? He keeps on repeating that. It's applicable in all times and for men and for women.
Well, because for females are exempt from mitzvah sesei shazman groma, time-bound positive commandments. It is repetitive. He could say, if I don't tell you otherwise, assume it's in all places, in all times, males and females, but he chose to repeat it and every single mitzvah independently for whatever reason, The over haleha, the regel al lishono, over alav. And if you do this, then you violated a negative commandment. The over al mitzvahs melech, just like you violated the king's command, the ain bo malchus, is not subject to the penalty of lashes, which is the general prohibition for violating regular negative commandments. Levishahu lav shein bo maisa, because even though it's a terrible thing, basically it's a lav shein bo maisa, meaning it just has to do with speech as opposed to action. So therefore, it's not subject to the penalty of malchus. But Sefer HaChinuch says, v'chama shluchim lamokom lahalkos, God has many messengers to lash you, milvad ritzua shel egel v'shel paros, besides a leather strap. So basically, you're going to have some sort of retribution if you speak Lashon Hara, not necessarily the actual physical kind with a leather strap, but if you speak Lashon Hara, rest assured that you're going to get your due. And there are many other halachos of Lashon Hara, including there's a funny concept that if the Lashon Hara is said in front of three people, so then it's no longer Lashon Hara. So what does that mean exactly? Does that mean that these three people are allowed to assume that it's now public information and now can go, don't have to worry about Lashon Hara? Everybody agrees you're not allowed to have kavana to spread this malicious information further, but maybe you don't have to be so careful about making sure not to open your mouth at all. If it's already been said in front of these three people, does it mean that the original sayer has said it beheter? So very unclear what the statement of the Gemara means, that when Lashon Hara says in front of three people, then it's okay. Then it's no longer actually subject to the penalty of Lashon Hara. Again, a lot more details. If you want to see, everybody should not just read, but review all the time the Sefer Chofetz Chaim, at least the Halachos of Lashon Hara and the Rambam, and the Shari Tshuva, many different places where you can find the exact details of the laws of Lashon Hara. Nowadays, again, we have this nice Sefer by Rabbi Feldman that really brings it home for contemporary times. The AFLP continues to say for Achinoch, and this is very interesting, that he spent just two paragraphs discussing Lashon Hara, and now he's going to go on for a page discussing a very specific sin of speech. Even though this penalty, this Lashon Hara does not have the penalty of Malkos, sometimes you could even be put to death for it. What does that mean? Ooh, sounds scary. See you in a second. Kayadua b'din moser. The famous din of a moser, somebody who delivers Jews to the secular government or to any non-Jew for some sort of justice purposes, is called a moser, and is one of the considered to be the worst type of people possible in halakha, to the extent that you're allowed to kill them, as we'll see in a second. V'zeh ha-din, hitiru chachomim lasos afilu b'chutz la'aretz l'tikun ha'olam, that you're allowed to do it even outside the land of Israel. It's not subject to the technical halachic judicial system of 23 judges who have the official smicha, who are the only people in general who are authorized to give the technical capital punishment in halacha. This is extrajudicial. Mutav yamus ish echad v'lo yazig v'abid l'rabim gufam o afilu mamonam. So better one person should die than he should be able to take somebody else's bodily, well-being. Ah, excellent. Bodily well-being and deliver it to the non-Jews, or even their money and deliver it to the non-Jews. So what are we talking about? We'll go on some details now. Bechtov loch b'ni, my son, I'm going to tell you, mat mimashish b'gemara b'nyan zeh. There's a lot of discussion in the Gemara about this. V'im tizke lo das, tire hakol b'mkomo. If you get to the point of knowing, you'll see, learning Gemara when you turn 15, right? That's what it says in Pirkei Avos. Ben chamesh le'el ha-Talmud. Garcina m'perek goes l'bas, the Gemara says above a kama, hahu gavra dach v'kari yadachiti devereish galusa. There was a certain fellow who showed the king where the exilarch kept his wheat stores. Chai ve Rav Nachman l'shalume. So Rav Nachman told him he had to pay for it, even though he didn't actually damage the Reish Galusa's property, the exilarch's property. He merely showed the goyim where to get it. You want some wheat? Go over there. It's in that silo right there. That's where the exilarch keeps his wheat stores. And see, I had to pay. The time of Mishum Dina de Garmi. So there are certain situations where even if you don't cause direct damage to someone's property, but more indirect damage, it can't be very indirect. There's sort of intermediate category of semi-indirect, which this case is, which is called Dina de Garmi, as opposed to Grumma bin Azikin, which is the less direct category. Any event, so he said that he had to pay because of Dina de Garmi. V'davka shehera me'atzmo aval mitocha ones pater, that if the king says, show me where the Exilar keeps his wheat. I want to collect it from him. Then you're exempt from penalty. So if the Jew is forced by the non-Jews to show where this fellow keeps his money, or where another Jew keeps his money, then he's exempt from repayment. Because the idea is you want to penalize someone who voluntarily said, over there, but you don't need to penalize someone who is under duress, right? Upershu Moreinu, the los of Dovra Nasu Begufo, that even if they didn't actually force him, they say, we're going to hurt you if you show it, but Ela Filan Sube Mamun, that if they said, you know, we're going to take money from you unless you show us where this other fellow's money is. Shikhulo Mamun, Imlo Yare Mamun Chavero, Vehero Pater, you're also exempt from punishment in that case. The Chol Mare Al Yede Ones Pater, anytime you're under duress, you're exempt. So that's the story. It's a whole discussion. Here, it's pretty much agreed that onus mamun is considered onus, but you have a whole discussion by Gittin also, that whether if monetary coercion is considered to be coercion. We know that we have a halacha that the husband has to give the get in most situations, I mean, all situations, but of his own will. So if the get is coerced in a manner that's not in consonance with halacha, so then the get is invalid. So the question is, if you go to the husband and you say, you know, give the get or we're going to shoot you or we're going to beat you up, then that's coercion. That's for sure, that it invalidates the get. But what happens if you say to the husband, go give the get or we're going to fine you? We're going to take away some money. Is that considered coercion as well? So that's a machlokas rishonim, whether that would be the case by get as well. And by the way, that's part of the reason that some poskim are opposed to the prenup, yeah, at least in its certain forms of the prenup, because basically what it says is that the husband owes the wife extra money if the Bezdin determines that he's, you know, delaying on improperly in giving her the get. So then if the monetary imposition is imposed not in accordance with halacha, then it could be a problem of a coerced get.
But wait a second, he agreed to the coercion, you know, when he signed the prenup.
Right, yeah. Because that's called an asmachta. Mm-hmm. They don't think it's ever really going to happen, and you just sign it because what the heck?
The rabbi said, I'm not going to marry anybody unless they do a prenup.
The RCA just said
that. No, but that's different. That if you don't have to go to this rabbi to be your Masada Kedushin. If you sign, according to the RCA rabbis, Rabbi Willig, if you sign the prenup of your own free will because it's part of also a Bezdin Chashuv, that it's the RCA Bezdin supports this, so it's called a Bezdin Chashuv, so there's no problem of a smachta. That's a whole other discussion we're not going to get into right now. But the worst problem, actually, is the New York get law. Mm-hmm. New York State get law, which states that if the judge finds one of the parties as delaying the other's remarriage in any way, either religious or civil, then the judge can take that into account in dividing the marital assets. Mm-hmm. In other words, if the court feels that the husband is delaying, has not given yet given a get, and therefore is causing an impediment to his wife's remarriage on a religious level, then the judge is going to award more of the marital assets to the woman. So that's a problem. That's called ones mamon. So according to this Rishonim, and the Ramo and Shulchan Aruch says that we're choshesh for a get, that ones mamon is a problem, at least lechatchila. Maybe it doesn't create a mamzer b'dieved if the get is given, but at least lechatchila, then we are concerned that that's considered to be a coerced get. So that's why in situations where there are monetary, there is money being contested in New York State courts when during a get process, It's actually a very big problem.
Isn't the get law still, I thought it was declared, you know, unconstitutional.
Not yet.
Oh,
Rabbi Bleich wants to be, he's not a lawyer, he's a scholar of law, but he's not a lawyer. So he said that he thinks that the law is absolutely unconstitutional because it takes the religious things into account. First of all, whether it's unconstitutional or not it definitely should be overturned, according to Rabbi Bleich, both in terms of American law, mostly in terms of Jewish law, that creates a lot of problems. That creates a lot of problems. I mean, most people, the reason that we still give gittin in New York is that we assume that most of the time, this doesn't really apply, that most of the time that the husband and wife are, both getting divorced and they want to have a get. So even though either he doesn't know about the get law or he doesn't really think about the get law, he just gives the get anyway. So that's considered to be okay. Rabbi Bleich says that's not true. If the law is on the books, you have to assume that every get, unless absolutely proven otherwise, you have to assume that every get given in New York is a shayla of a get nosa. And that's why Rabbi Willig, who's lemaisa, he's mekel that we can still do gittin in New York State. Most rabbis, obviously, still conduct gittin in New York State. But everybody agrees, almost everyone, I would say, agrees that the law should not be on the books. It just creates problems. It's the point of the law is to extract gittin from husbands, more or less, but it gets bustled, so it doesn't help you that much. Vim nosa v'nosan bayad chayev. That afila yidei ones nefashos, that even if they threaten to kill you if you don't give over this other person's property, you're still chayef to repay if you actually take the property and hand it over to the other person. Vim to the goyim. Vim tomar ein loch davar shomed bifnei pikuach nefesh. Say what? It's pikuach nefesh. Of course you should be allowed to do it. Yesh lomar miyam. Why should you have to reimburse him then? Yesh lomar miyam rina leyamos velo yitain. They say, so what do you mean? There's not the two options over here, to die or to give the other person's money. Yiten v'yishalem, kam rinan lei. Give your own money in order to avoid dying, and you don't have to take this person's money. Belo yatzel atzmo b'mamon chaveru. Don't save yourself with somebody else's money. Be'afilu ben nirdav shaya b'oreach v'pnei rodev v'shover kelov chayev. So let's say someone's literally running after you to kill you, and you're running away from that person. So if you trip over someone else's vessels and you break them, you have to repay. That's also pikuach nefesh, so it has nothing to do with each other. Mm-hmm. You didn't do it on purpose. So even here, it is kavana. You're doing it bechavana. You're coerced, but lemaisa, you realize you're now taking someone's property and handing it over to someone else. So it's interesting that if they coerced you to show them where it was, and you showed them where it was, then they could take it themselves, but you happen to be the one handing it over, so in that situation, then you are not chayev, because they could just take it themselves. They knew where it was already, and you didn't actually inflict any damage. That once it was shown to them, then that was it. It was considered to be already destroyed. Because you're showing them also doesn't cause you to be chayev because you were coerced. So a certain fellow who showed where the wine of these people was, coercedly. Amri le dari v'amti, dari v'amti, v'asikna d'cheven d'okminu al ilave miklo kalia v'shuvein ha-mischayev alav. So he showed them where it was, then they said, okay, now bring it to me. So just because he brought it to him, brought it to the king's house in this case, apparently, then he was not liable because it was coerced, and he showed them before he actually took it and transferred it to the other person's domain. So if you showed it of yourself without coercion, then not only do you have to pay back, but you are liable to be killed. What does that mean? The Garsina Hasam. It says in the Gemara over there in Bava Kama, Hahu Gavra Dahava Boy Dinachavi Beitavna Dahavre. There was a certain person who went to in front of big rabbis. And he said, I am going to show where the straw storage of my fellow is. Aslakami the Rav, he said this in front of Rav. Amarle Rav, lo tavid achi. So Rav said, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to show the goyim where to take the somebody else's property. Kilomar hitribo. So he warned him not to do it. Lo havat sois. He said, no, I am determined to give over my friend's property.
Your friend.
So have a Rav Kahana kamei the Rav. Come Rav Kahana shamte lekoi. So Rav Kahana got up and broke his neck, and kolmar harago that he killed him. V'achi mucha chad amar le Rav Kahana ha'idna malchusa de parsoi hu v'kafti av shvichus damim. So it means even nowadays, because it says, oh, nowadays the... it's talking about, we have the Persian kingdom, and they're careful about shvichas damim, that they, it's about killing people. So he said, oh, maybe that maybe the government is going to get you for this, because he actually killed him. In other words, sometimes it uses language, the Gemara uses language that suggests bloodshed, where it doesn't really literally mean literal bloodshed. But here it is talking about literal bloodshed. V'amrina nami v'gemara gabi mai devayalan mamon moseri mutar la'abdo. The Gemara asks the question, if a certain amount, if about the money, the property of somebody who was said he was going to give over this property to the non-Jews. Umahadrina lo yu mamono chamar migufo. Alma dugufo mutar la'abdo. So it says, well, maybe you shouldn't consider his money more valuable than his life, so therefore you're allowed to destroy his property the same way you're allowed to destroy his life. Well, you find out in the conclusion that that's not true. You're not allowed to destroy the property of a moser because maybe he has heirs who are very righteous and they can use it. Mihu. Oh, now we're going to get into qualifications. So lest you now go around with a machete, you know, happily offing people who are... who threatened to deliver the goods. Mihu davka b'shas maisa v'yedei hasra. Has to be at a time where the person threatens to give over the property, and he has to be warned. Uch maisa d'rav kahana, like the story that we just told. Ve'inu tzarech shekabel av hasra k'shar chayav b'miso. Because it's sort of extra judicial, so he doesn't have to accept the warning. He didn't have to say, yes, I understand that this is forbidden, and I'm going to do it anyway. He just has to continue in his, he has to hear and continue in his threat to give over the money, to deliver the stuff. Umi, but, then you're allowed to kill him. Umi shemuchzak limsor nira shehu kemusra v'omed. And somebody who's considered to be a, somebody who's always does this, who does this consistently, so umutel hargo b'cholsha. So they're allowed to kill him at any time. As the Gemara says, where is this derived from? It says that aminim v'amasoros, certain types of people, included which are people who consistently do this, then moridin v'lo malin, that you bring about their death. So it's a shayla if you're allowed to kill them directly.
And
if,
how come they couldn't continue doing it? How come they weren't killed directly?
Well, the people didn't get around to them. I don't know, maybe they had good bodyguards and trying to... So you're allowed to kill them at least indirectly and maybe even directly. But if somebody is on the verge of actually delivering a Jew, either in body or property to the non-Jews, then it's like a rodef, that the person, if you keep, this person is going to create strife, is going to, between the Jewish and non-Jewish community. Remember, in the olden days, there was a lot of risk of persecution and bloodshed for the Jews. So therefore, this person, basically, this is based on the din of a rodef, that this person who's running after his fellows, either property, which is going to lead to potentially to bloodshed, or is actually going to deliver the person to the non-Jews. So that's considered to be a rodef, just like we know that the halach is, if a person is running after someone else to kill him. So if you have no other choice to prevent them from doing it, then you're allowed to kill the person in order to prevent them from attaining their goal. So here is basically the same idea. There's a somewhat funny story that someone told me about his co-op board, I think, in Israel. So somebody said that somebody got up at a co-op board meeting and said, you know, I understand there's certain people are not paying their co-op fees on time. If anybody continues to do this, I'm going to report you to the government. So this friend of mine stood up and said, as far as I'm concerned, they're allowed to kill you because he's a moser. Okay, well, maybe, maybe not.
Why would the government care about
him? They're going to crack down on him and make them pay the fees. I don't know exactly why. Anyway, the point of the story is, that was the point of the story. So the question is also as to whether the din of Moser applies as a whole machlokes. There's a very nice essay I found actually online by none other than Michael Broyd, actually. But he wrote a nice little essay about different approaches to, is there the din of Moser nowadays when we have, in, let's say, the U.S., where we have a just government that's not, you know, doesn't treat people differently because they're Jewish, etc. So is there a din of Moser? So the opinions range from, there's absolutely no din of Moser whatsoever. Feel free to hand your fellow Jews over to the IRS. Government. IRS, that's a big shilek. Are you allowed to work for the IRS because you're reporting on the Jews who didn't pay their taxes? You're reporting on them to the government for punishment. That's a big shilek. So that's one opinion. One approach is that there's no difference whatsoever. We don't find in halachic sources all these things. So anytime you give a Jew over to a non-Jew, either in body or property, it's a problem. It doesn't make a difference how just the government is. And one person had an excellent point. Actually, he quoted the name of Rav Ezra Batzri, the Dayan. He said that prison is always sakanas nefashos. That if you give a Jew into the U.S. government, then he could be thrown in prison. And in prison, people can be attacked, or they could be raped, they could be have all these things happen to them that are terrible. First of all, not to mention the fact that prison, let's say for crimes involving money, is absolutely incorrect according to Jewish law. There's no such thing as imprisoning or people at all, really, but except in, you know, crazy cases, when that's what the Bezdin feels they need to do, but they should really, it's not an appropriate punishment, which is another sheet on the list, which is that, which is a quote from Rav Shmuel Vosner, which is that when the punishment of the U.S. government would be similar to what the Jewish law punishment would be, then you're allowed to give them in, but which would not be assumed in the olden days that would be anything resembling the Jewish law punishment at all, then you're allowed. But according to other poskim, again, there's no difference whatsoever. And you're not allowed to hand in Jews at all or to the government. V'dasa Rambam Zichrono Levracha, let's just finish quickly because we're not going to meet for a while. We want to get this done. V'dasa Rambam Zichrono Levracha, the Rambam says, Shekosav bedin moser kachu, that's the halach of the moser. Kevan shamar hareini moser ploni begufo obemamona, the person declares his intent to give over a Jew to non-Jews in any way. Bafilu mamon kal, even if it's for 3 cents, doesn't matter. Hare zehiter atzmo lemisa, once a person says such a thing, they expose themselves to the possibility of being killed. Umasrimbo, the Omrim lo altimsor. We say, no, you're not allowed to hand over Jews to the non-Jews in any way. I'm going to do it anyway. Mitzvah lahargo, the cholakodim lahargo zacha. So it's a mitzvah. You shouldn't be, this would be a misplaced mercy, saying, no, let's find another way. Let's not do it. Because if you have such mercy on him, he's going to cause problems for the Jewish community, for his fellow Jews. He's like a rodef. It's somebody, you have to look at it in a broader perspective of what this person has the potential of doing. So just like if somebody's running after someone else with a gun, obviously you're allowed to kill the person with a gun. So you don't say, I can't, I'm too merciful, I'm not going to kill this person. That's wrong. You have to save the person from this person's designs. The victim, I mean. Thus, but the Rambam adds a very important caveat, which is that if the Moser did the deed already, then you're not allowed to kill him because he already did it. You're not. It's like the Rodef. Once the Rodef, he's chasing after someone with a gun. If he ends up killing the victim, then he's punished for the murder for whatever he did. But he's not. You're not allowed to just kill him extrajudicially. You're not allowed to kill him extrajudicially at that point because he did it already. There's nothing you're preventing him from doing. Elim Cain says the Rabbam Huchzak Limsor Hareze Yehorig Shema Yimsor Achirim Ad Kol Lashon Rav. Again, but if it's a Mosor, which is a different Moser, means somebody is. It's a participle. It's somebody who does it now. A Mosor means somebody who, it's a different form of the noun, means somebody who's known for doing these things, then even if after they've done it 25 times, but they've completed their last act of Mesira, well, unless you have good proof that this person is doing tshuva and not going to do it again, then you can assume that they're going to do it again, and you're allowed to kill them. Hatzarech hasra, lemish eina muchzak limsor, but somebody, then that person does not even need hasra. You don't need to say about their next Mesira case, if you do it again, we're going to kill you, because you're allowed to kill them even after the fact. Assuming, again, because the assumption is they're going to continue. Vashia Kabbal hasra doesn't need that. Ulamishahu muchzak limsor nira mitoch dvarav she'eino tzarech hasra. Again, he doesn't need hasra at all. Again, even if somebody says, if somebody's muchzak limsor, then even if they say, I'm about to go maser somebody, then they still don't need, you don't need to give them hasra at all, because again, they're part of this group of people who are assumed to do it, so you can just kill them on the spot. Ve'ein ha-moser yochol lomar bishvil sheploni meitzer li'ani mosro biyad goyim, she'ein ze potro me'onsho. So on an individual level, it does not work to say, I find this fellow Jew really annoying, and he is does terrible things to me. He's a bad neighbor. He blasts his music late at night, and he's taking my money, and he's who knows what else he's doing. So I'm going to turn him into the government because he doesn't pay his taxes. So that's not allowed on an individual level. But aval hamitzer l'tzibur, somebody who's a danger to the general community, mutar l'tzibur l'mosro b'yad goyim. So you're allowed to turn him into the non-Jews for them to exact whatever justice or punishment they're going to do. So this is also very important in terms of child molesters. It's the main thing nowadays, that you're allowed to turn them in right away, even if you hold there's a problem this year in the U.S., which again, we saw that there were poskim who said that there's no problem at all with turning in Jews to the government in the U.S. because it's a just government. We don't normally really accept that opinion. We assume that there is still a problem of Masira. Nevertheless, somebody like that, which is the, you know, what everybody's talking about nowadays, then you still have to turn them in because certainly they have the potential of causing great harm to the Tzibor, and the Jewish community at the present time does not have the power to deal with them. If the Jewish community were totally independent and had their own prisons and whatever, there wouldn't be any point in turning them into non-Jews. We're talking about in a situation where the Beis Din does not feel they have the power to address the threat posed by this person properly, and then you're allowed to turn him into to the government. The Asur La'abed Mamon Moser, but the Halach L'maisa, you're not allowed to destroy the money of a Moser, Mishum Rosh Yachin Vetzadik Yilbash. Literally, the wicked person will prepare and the righteous person will wear. Kedasigno Perika Gozel, that the Gemara says that just why should the money suffer? Maybe he has a child or another heir who is a tzaddik and he can benefit from the Moser's money. So even though Halacha L'maisa, I mean, we don't really exercise this so much nowadays because the American government is going to get us if we exercise the Nemoser, but technically speaking, according to Halacha, this is still absolutely in effect, and you would be allowed to kill someone who would Maser, maybe not to the U.S. government because you'd suffer, but because of the idea that maybe there's no Masera to the U.S. government, but in any event, this would you're not allowed to destroy his property because people who deserve it could potentially derive a benefit from it.